I'm Chuck C. from Laguna B. Ah. My, what a beautiful sight this is. I think one of the greatest things about being a circuit rider is to be able to stand up here and see all you beautiful people. You see, I know what you used to look like. And this is an improvement that can only be described as a miracle. With only Alateen and Al-Anon and AA talent you have around here, you need me just about as much as you need another boll weevil down here in Georgia. But I'm awful glad you thought you needed me, because I've had a wonderful 3 days with you already. I'm mighty glad to be here, and I'm mighty glad you're here. I always think if you're going to make a talk, it's nice if somebody comes to listen, you know? Hell! And I'm very grateful to you for coming. On Thursday morning, Mrs. C and I went by the hospital and got to spend a minute or two with Lewis, and we had a real nice visit with Marion. And I thought Lewis recognized us. He had a faint smile on his face. And I think that with all the prayers that he has from our fellowship, that he's going to be with us for the next convention. We miss him here. I can give you a good recipe for not sleeping. I didn't sleep last night. I was trying all night to get old Pelham back home, you know? As you know, the funny part of it was that all the time Pelham was trying to get back home and couldn't make it, I was home and I didn't know where I was. The only times I was known was when the gendarmes had me detained without my permission. But when I finally did wake up, I had to get acquainted with my own house and my own wife and my own kids and my own backyard. And here I'd been there all the time. In the flesh. And so I wonder if we alcoholics ever get home until we at long last come to ourselves. And through this great fellowship of ours, uncover the thing that we've been looking for all our lives. I am certain that no alcoholic is ever a free man or a free woman until he comes back home and does the things necessary to uncover himself. I am certain that the thing that you and I have forever been searching for, we have always had. And the thing that we have always wanted to know, we have always known. But we didn't know it. We have to find it out. I spent 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven, sitting in the same chair, in the same living room, with the same wife and the same kids. 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven. And then we moved to Laguna Beach, and that chair of mine didn't fit with the color scheme in the living room, and they put it in the den. And it took me five years to get it on back in the living room. And now after 18 years and 9 months and 14 days, I'm in the same chair. And still in heaven. Now nothing happened to the chair, nothing happened to the living room, nothing happened to the wife or the kids in the beginning. But something happened to me. And I moved out of hell into heaven. So it proved that heaven was always there. I was away. I wonder if we have ever thought too much about the fact that the only thing that we cannot change in life, the one thing that we cannot change, is that we can't get away from ourselves. We can get away from everything else. We don't have to keep the same wife. I'm in a rut. I've had mine for 39 years. But we don't have to keep the same wives or the same husbands. We don't have to stay with our children. We don't have to stay in the same town or the same state or the same country. There's nothing that says that we have to do anything except one. And that is that we have to live with ourselves. We're stuck with us. And there's no way for us to get away from it. We simply can't get away from the fact that we are stuck with us. And why in the world it takes us so long to make friends with ourselves, I don't know. You see, our problem is to be able to live with us. To be able to be comfortable in our own company. That's always been our problem. We didn't think it was. Until I ran out of time, people, places, things, health, money, sanity, home, job, and choice. It was not my fault that I drank. It was your fault. If you stupid people had have lived like I knew you should, and like I told you how, because I knew how you should live, and I told you, but you wouldn't live like I thought you ought to, so I got drunk at you. Ha And I got a drunk at a lot of you. Believe me. And it was never my fault. I had to run out of everything to come to see that if there be fault, it's mine. If there be fault, it's mine. And I think one of the greatest days in any individual's life, from the cradle to the grave, is that day when we can and do accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are. This is a fabulous thing. I said I am an alcoholic. I am neither proud of it nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. Now, something has to happen before we can say that. This is something that nobody must know, not even us. And we go to any length to keep anybody from knowing that. If 20 years ago any one of you had called me an alcoholic, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I'd have hit you right smack in the nose if I could have seen you. This is something that nobody must know. And how wonderful it is to be able to accept this fact. I am an alcoholic. And it don't make a particle of difference to me. It doesn't bother me. Doesn't bother me in the least. I'm neither proud of it nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. Now, I think until that happens to us, Pelham could never get home. Never. I liken it to a hunter, a woodsman, that knows the woods backwards. This man could not get lost in the woods. He knows all about the woods. And he's out hunting, and comes time to go home, and he starts out of the woods. And he knows exactly how to get out of the woods. So he walks long enough to be out of the woods, and he finds himself right back where he started. And he discovers that he's lost. And as soon as he discovers that he's lost, he can get out. Because then he picks a few landmarks and he marks a few trees and he goes in the same direction and he gets out of the woods. And so it is with us. We can't get out of our predicament because we don't know what we're in. As long as it's somebody else's fault, we can't get out of this predicament. How are you going to go anyplace if you don't know where you are? You can't get there from here. And so it is, we have to come to see that if there be fault, it is mine. I'm one who believes there are only two classes of alcoholics who can and do fulfill the conditions for sobriety. The first class I belong to, in crisis, when there is nothing else to do, it's simple to fulfill the conditions for sobriety. It's amazing how easy it is to surrender when you ain't got nothing to give up. And that's the first class. And the second class are those who come to see the nature of our problem. I am convinced that if we be alcoholic, we either have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, or we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. or we will not fulfill the conditions of sobriety. Because, you see, the first condition for sobriety is surrender. The very first condition is to give up the fight. To recognize the need for help. To recognize that of ourselves we have lost the battle. And an alcoholic can't do this. We simply can't, because it's not our nature to surrender. We were not born to surrender. We were born to win. And we almost did it. We almost did it. I call us the almost people. Almost were we able to take exactly what we wanted out of life on our own terms. But we got just a little bit alcoholic. And that's all, brother. But thinking that surrender has to do with weakness. We can't surrender because we hate weakness. We hate weakness. If there's one thing that alcoholics hate almost above all others, it's weakness in anybody. And much more so in ourselves. I was saying to me for at least 10 years after I had lost, I'll win this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. Because I was one who couldn't surrender. I think there are two reasons that we keep fighting so long. Number one is that we can't surrender. And number two is that, in my own case at least, the only peace I had ever known in my entire lifetime was at those times in the early days of my drinking, when I could get right there, exactly right, when I was all right with myself and you were all right with me and the world was good. In those times, I was at peace with myself and the world. And as I started going down the alcoholic route, after I had become a compulsive drinker, and things got more and more confused, and I became less and less adequate in all departments of my life. The memory of these periods of peace were very strong within me. And I was trying to get back there. And that whole last 10 years, I was trying to get back. And I never made it once. Not once. I could almost make it. I'd almost get there, and I'd either go through or fall back. But I was always trying, because that was the only peace I'd ever known, until I found my peace in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for these two reasons, we just beat our brains out, trying to win something that nobody ever won. And so it's good, I think, for us to spend just a few minutes on the nature of our problem itself. Alcoholism is a disease. It's medically classified as someplace between the first and the fourth killer in the country today. It's a terminal disease. I Wish I didn't get these little curlicues that run through my mind. Because this is serious. But I keep thinking, wouldn't it be awful if we just had a little bitty old disease like chicken pox or something like that? For a bunch of alkies to have a little bitty old disease, that'd kill us in itself. But to think we're someplace between first and fourth, you know, this helps us a great deal to know this. Many doctors throughout this country and Canada who have spent much time in the research in alcohol, the disease of alcoholism, have given as their private opinion that if the heart failures and brain explosions that should be attributed to alcoholism were, that alcoholism right now would be tops, number one, as a killer in the country. The medical definition of the disease is that it is a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Now, the allergy of the body means simply this, that my body, for some reason unknown to anybody, even medical science, cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize, burn up, and get rid of alcohol. When I take a slug of liquor, I retain it. It goes into the bloodstream, into the brain, and it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. Now, this is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of the alcoholic. We are different physically and mentally than the so-called normal drinker. Now, this is an awful good thing to know. This is an awfully good thing to know. One of the things that used to drive me absolutely nuts was the fact that people that didn't have anything like my physical strength and certainly were not in the same class with me mentally. A lot of these monkeys were telling me, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit. And this just drove me nuts. I would say, why in the hell can't I drink? He does, and he ain't got it. And my answer to me was, you can, and you gotta prove it. And there I was trying to prove it 10 years after it lost. And I never knew that I was different, both physically and mentally, than that guy that was saying, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit. There are two or three things about the physical side of the disease that are most necessary that I keep right up in the top of my consciousness at all times. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And I have to laugh again, because there are certain... authorities. I have to duck when I say that. Who insist otherwise now? There's a book now that you can get anyone that's interested in it, titled The Cured Alcoholic. Same guy that wrote that thing in the Post the other day. Maybe he's seen one that was cured. But all of them that I have seen that thought they were cured, we've had to bury. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. This is necessary for me to remember. Secondly, that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total abstinence. This is very necessary for me to remember. The physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long, extended periods of total abstinence. Now, I am 18 years, 9 months, and 14 days worse off, so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned, than I was when I got here. And my good wife here could tell you that I was not in what would be termed robust health when I came. Now, I know that I am 18 years, 9 months, and 14 days worse off. And I don't have to take that drink to prove it. Because I have been close to and active in this program for all this time. And when you're close to and active in this program, you don't have to try it. Your friends are forever trying it for you. I don't believe that there's anything that we have to do in AA that is quite so much of a heartbreak as to sit in the dark room with that man or that woman who has had 10, 12, 15, 20 years without a drink and who forgot this. It's a rough go. But it does one thing. It makes it unnecessary for us to take the drink ourselves. Because we can see that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time. And we don't have to try it. And lastly, there's no cure for the physical side of the disease. If we had all the money in the state of Georgia, it wouldn't be enough to send me someplace to get a cure for my body. There isn't any such thing. So what are we going to do about it? I have accepted the fact that I have no more good drinking time left, period. That I never will have any more good drinking time left, period. Now, if seeing this, we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we wouldn't have a problem. It is not difficult for an alcoholic to see that it's the first drink that's killing him, after it's explained to us. I was never concerned with the first drink. It wasn't the first drink that was bothering me, it was the last gallon. You see, I was a periodic. And a periodic don't get drunk with one drink. We get cute. You see, we get sober, and particularly if you're a periodic for the same reason I was, because I was going to win this thing. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. So I became a periodic in order to get well enough to get back in the ring. And so we come off a drunk and immediately put all our energies into getting healthy again. And we eat well and sleep well and take our exercise and eat vitamins by the buckets full. And when we get physically well, we start to analyze. And we take that last drunk apart. And we see where we made our mistakes. And we decide not to do it that way anymore. And when we're mentally and physically ready, we start sampling. And we sample our way right on back to bed. But not quickly. We just sort of slide into it easily. We never miss. We always get back there, but it's not in a hurry. So it had never occurred to me that it was first rate that was doing it until you people told me. And just as soon as you told me that it was the first slug, that it was too many and 1,000 weren't enough, I could see it very plainly. And if seeing this, we could decide to quit drinking and quit, we'd be home free. We just say to ourselves, okay, the stuff isn't doing for me what it used to. It's giving me nothing but trouble now. There's nothing good about it. I'll just cork the bottle and put it on the shelf and leave it. If we could do that, we'd be a cinch. But we can't. Why? Because the other half of the disease, the mental obsessions that cause us to drink. You see, when the body is dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. It's only after the first slug has been taken that the physical takes over. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink is physical, but the first one is mental. And if you and I, being alcoholic, want to be rid of the bottle, we have to be rid of the mental obsessions that cause us to drink. The reason you never hear anything about willpower, backbone, and standing up and being a man in Alcoholics Anonymous is because we know that it's just as silly for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. If the tubercular is going to get rid of the cough, he has to be rid of its cause, tuberculosis. And if you and I, being alcoholic, want to get rid of the bottle, we have to be rid of its cause, the obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. Now, how are we going to do that? That's exactly what this program of ours is all about. We just recognize the physical part of the disease, dismiss it, and turn to the program of recovery that will rid us of the mental obsessions. Now, that's the reason we like our big book so well. You see, the big book not only tells us what's wrong with us, it not only tells us our problem, it not only gives us a program of recovery, but it tells us why we couldn't do it ourselves. All the way through, that big book says we lack the power. We lack the power. Lack of power was our dilemma, says the book. And it was obvious if we lacked the power, we had to find one. And it was just as obvious that it'd be a power greater than ourselves. This I believe as I believe that I'm here, and for just a simpler reason. If I could have beaten this rap myself, I would not believe that. I could not beat it. Therefore, I believe it. I lack the power. Where was the power when I was waking up in jail? I never did get to the point where I was comfortable in jail. I never did. I simply don't like it in jail. But I think my friends, and particularly my family, thought I loved it down there. I was there so often. I lacked the power. Where was the power? When I was writhing in the floor, chewing my tongue full of holes and babbling like an idiot in an alcoholic convulsion. Certainly isn't much power there. But I did it. Many times. I've heard people say you can't do that but five times, but I know better. I know better. But I think that I ran out of my convulsions. All of them. Because the last time I went down, I didn't chew my tongue and I didn't babble. I just spread out there as nicely as anything you ever saw. I didn't even move. Mrs. C. and our son Dick were sitting in the living room, and I'd sneaked out in the kitchen to get me a glass of buttermilk. Just trying to sober up. And they heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out there expecting to find me chewing my tongue, but I wasn't. There I was, just laying there, peaceful. I was a peculiar color. I looked a great deal like a cadaver. And they couldn't wake me up, so they got exercised and got the oxygen squad down there. You know, that's tickled me too. I got a lot of fun out of thinking about some of these things. You know, you come off drunk, and you're hot as a two-bit pistol, and everybody in town's looking for you. 90% of them just to tell you they never want to see you again. Why all the fuss? And I'm pretty sure that my wife and our kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they come out and find me dead. And they get all exercised and get the oxygen squad down there to wake me up. They finally brought me to. And they told me that to all intents and purposes I was dead. And that they, in their opinion, nobody would ever be able to bring me back from that kind of a state again. And they told me if they were me, they wouldn't do that anymore. They were again it. But I did it again. Why? I lack the power. I lack the power. More to the point, however, would be this. Between every two drunks for 10 years, I was physically as sober as I am right now. Between every two drunks for 10 years. Now, where was the power when I was feeling just as physically fit as I am right now? When I'd gotten back into the good graces of my family and my business associates. And everything was going good. And I'd be going home one night, and out of the no place would come the thought, well, you're going home to eat. Now, anybody knows that one drink won't hurt you if you eat. Why don't you drop into Joe's and get a double? Where was the power? I dropped into Joe's and never did get home. I lack the power, and I believe the book when it says, under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems there is only one defense against that first slug, the drink I must not take, and that is help from a power greater than myself. Now, how are we going to get it? Thank God we have a formula. And all we have to do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula. And something happens. The power is added, and we don't have to drink anymore. Now, the first condition of the formula we find in chapter 3, where it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. This is what we were talking about in the beginning. That we come at long last to see that if there be fault, it is mine, to be able to accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are. And this, again, is the reason that these meetings are so tremendously important. Because as alcoholics, we have to be able to identify with each other as alcoholics before we can identify with the disease of alcoholism. That's the great importance of these meetings. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The second condition we find in the preamble, where it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Now, when we become willing to go to any length, that puts sobriety number one on our hit parade. And I am one who believes that unless and until sobriety becomes number one, we alcoholics cannot have it. And that unless it remains number one, we are on thin ice. Now, this is awfully hard for us as alcoholics and for the non-alcoholic world to see. It's very difficult. Mrs. C. told you this afternoon that for the first 6 months I was in this program, I never talked with her about it at all. She was in the process of getting rid of me legally. And I attended meetings every night for 6 months with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have this thing. I didn't think I had enough left mentally or physically to get it. I decided my first evening, my first night with you, that I wanted what you had. And I became willing to go to any length to get it. But I left a meeting with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have it. And for 6 months, I was in a meeting every night, dogged with this great fear that I couldn't have it. And after 6 months, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been all the time. And this was the beginning. This was the first of a series of awakenings that lasted for almost 19 years. And when I woke up to the fact that I was sober, then I talked to Mrs. C. about it. And she asked me to take her to a meeting. She had already read the book probably two or three times. And so she wanted to go with me, and I took her. And maybe it was 3 months after this that I was asked to say a few words in the Beverly Hills meeting, which was my home group for 11 years. And I got up, talked a little, and I ended the talk by saying that if it were necessary tonight for me to go to Tibet to maintain what I'd found in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would go home, pack my little grip, come through the living room, kiss my wife goodbye, and say, honey, I'm sorry, I have to go. Now, I didn't think that was bad. But shortly after we got home, I felt the house moving, and I was wondering if we were having another earthquake. Until I looked over and I saw my wife just crying her eyes out. And I said, well, honey, what's the matter with you? And she says, oh, what you said. She says, here for the first time in 20 years, we have the opportunity for a little peace and a little happiness and a little joy in this household. Why, she says, don't I mean anything to you? Don't the home mean anything to you? Don't the kids mean anything to you? Boo-hoo. And I let her cry and says there was a break. And I says, honey, do I mean anything to you drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to the kids drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to me or to life drunk? And she says, no. But I says, can't you see that this has to be first? And she couldn't. She couldn't. But she would be the first to tell you tonight that whatever I feel to be necessary to maintain myself in this way, I have her permission to do it. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says, here are the steps we took. T-double-O-K, took. Now, that's one of the greatest lines in our book. That's the line. Here are the steps we took. It doesn't say, here are the steps we read. It doesn't say, here are the steps we learned by heart. Hi, John. Ha ha. It doesn't say here the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting. It doesn't say here the steps we interpreted. And oh, this just kills me. Interpreted. I've been reading those steps and hearing them and trying to do something about them for putting it 20 years. And I haven't found a big word in one of them. There isn't anything in there that has to be interpreted. I didn't even have to go to the dictionary to see what in the words meant. Doesn't say interpreted. We got a guy out there in the valley now on my way that's teaching the interpretation of the steps for a fee. For a fee yet he's doing it. It don't say here are the steps we interpreted. Thank God I got here too late to interpret. Neither does it say, here are the steps we conned God into taking for us. It says, here are the steps we took. Now, if you happen to be an alcoholic, and if you happen to want to be rid of that bottle, took them. Just took them. Took them and something happens. Don't took them and nothing happens. And I was meeting not too long ago at home, and it was sort of a thing, I guess, and everybody came, and there wasn't any place for me to sit down. And I was going to yak in a little while anyway, so I was standing back at the podium. I never read the preamble in the 12 steps. And they got down, here are the steps we took, which are suggested, and I laughed out loud. And I was very embarrassed because there I stood and everybody could see me. And that's no place to laugh out loud, you know. And this is what went through my mind. I thought, what a sneaky way to bring about a shotgun wedding, you know. Ha, ha. They say there are no musts, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I very jolly well better took these steps or I'm going to die. That's all there is to it. This is a must with me. That I take these steps and apply them to my very own self one day at a time to the best of my ability. And when I do that, something happens, the power is added, and I don't have to drink anymore. It is this simple. And this is the only thing that's the matter with our program. It is this simple, and you and I cannot believe it's this simple. We look at it, and we say, it can't be that simple. There is bound to be a tougher way than this, and I'm going to find it. We say to ourselves, if these black lines mean so much, the white lines have got some meaning in them, too. And we start reading between the lines. The only thing wrong with it is that simple. Here are the steps we took. We're sober. If you want this thing, do these things. And something will happen. There is a miracle here, but we don't bring it about. We don't even pray it about, in my way of thinking. We do it about. We take these steps and apply them to our very own selves, to the best of our ability, as honestly as we can get. And something happens to us. Now, we start over again. How many of you people can dance? Square dance. I had to get sober for 5 years to find out I couldn't dance. I got to give a stair lessons when I was drunk. Ha ha. I agree with the doctor. I have an allergy to the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. I am condemned by the obsessions of the mind to drink liquor. And I am condemned by the allergy of the body to die if I do, and I know it. Because I spent everything I had to prove it weren't true. I spent my health, my time, my home, my money. Everything I had, I spent to prove that this were not true. And I proved that it was. And so I know it. But I think there's something else. I think there's another factor in this disease of alcoholism. I think that there's something that probably preceded the obsessions of the mind and the allergy of the body. Inasmuch as there has only been one answer for the alcoholic from the beginning of time, and that is a basic spiritual rest. Now, what I mean by that? Why am I not drunk tonight? I'm 2,500 miles away from home. It's Saturday. What better day is it to be drunk than Saturday? When it's Saturday. Why am I not drunk tonight? It's not normal for an alcoholic to be away from home and be sober. Because I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I've got the thing. I don't hurt in here anymore. That king-size hurt is gone. I'm not fighting me. I'm not fighting you. And I'm not fighting my God. I am at peace with me and with you and with my God. And that's the only reason I'm not drunk. If there was a fight between me and that bottle, I would lose it tonight. I never won it in my life. My only hope is that I don't hurt in here like I used to. That I so maintain myself in this program that that big hurt don't come back. Now, this is what I mean by basic spiritual rest. Inasmuch as this is the only answer there has ever been for the alcoholic problem, then it seems kindergarten to me that the problem behind the problem is a basic spiritual unrest. And the reason I said a little bit ago, if there be fault, it is mine, is because I do not believe it is fault. I do not believe. No alcoholic on earth enjoys the life he has to live after he becomes a compulsive drinker. You can't tell me that it was a taste of that flit that kept me fighting 10 years after I'd lost and going down for the count every time. It's much more basic than that. It is a living problem. Alcoholism is a living problem, and you and I have to have a living answer, lest we drink again. Now, the reason I don't think that we're at fault is because not one of us, not one woman, or not one man in this room ever set about to become an alcoholic. We are a peculiar breed of cats, we alkies. Now, I've come to believe, after almost 19 years in this program, that the first two words of the little prayer that we're about to say to close this meeting mean exactly what they say. Our Father. Our Father God. Now, if God is our Father, we are His children. It has to be. And I am convinced that our Father God has always known this, but you and I individually have to find it out for ourselves. We have to make this great discovery. And if we happen to be alcoholics, we won't take anybody else's word for it. We say to ourselves, by whose authority? I was telling them the other night, not too long ago, I stopped by the 12-step house over home, one of them. And it was late night, I'd been out yakking someplace, and I just stopped by to see what was going on. And there was nobody in the front part of the house door, so I went back, pushed the door open in the coffee room. And there were two or three guys sitting there with a guy that was real new. And he wasn't quite ready to admit, you know, that there was any power greater than he was. This is the worst admission that any alcoholic has to make anyway. We don't find them any bigger than we are, you know. And just as I pushed the door open, this guy was saying, who wrote the Bible? Who wrote it? You know? Man! And I said, there's my boy. You know? There's my boy. You see, we can't take from the regular sources. We've got to find out ourselves. We won't take anybody's word for it. And so what it takes, it takes. And how long it takes, it takes. But we can't settle for less than the answer because of our very natures. Now, the combination of characteristics that are so evident in alcoholics is not exclusively ours. I mean, the characteristics aren't exclusively ours, but the combination is. You know, we come here thinking we are so different. Nobody has ever had our problems. We are different. And if we remain, we find out that we're as like as black-eyed peas. Every one of them. And whilst we don't have exclusive on these little characteristics that I'm going to mention, we have the exclusive on the alcoholic combination of them. Number one, we are a bunch of perfectionists, a bunch of idealists. Now, perfectionism is a good thing when we learn to live with it. But it's terrible until we do. Because we make demands upon ourselves that we can't fulfill. And we make demands upon the life around us that they can't fulfill. And we have to go out and make everybody over. And particularly those who are close to us. We demand perfectionism, and we got to make them over. And they don't want to be made over. It's not a good way to win friends and influence people. Because they don't need to be made over. They're not hurting like we are. But we have to make them over in order to live with them. And this is one of our problems. Another one of our problems is that we were born with the interior awareness that life is a good and a big and a beautiful thing. You and I, recovering alcoholics, have known since we're knee-high to a duck that this kind of life that we have right now is the life that we had to have. From the time we were kids, this has been our idea of what life should be. But we looked at it and it wasn't. And this was one of our problems. We couldn't integrate into the society around us because we did not like it. And we had one more characteristic that is awful hard to explain. the world, they can't understand it. Because we are a highly sensitive, highly emotional people. How do you expect the world to believe this when there we lay in the gutter and the pig got up and slowly walked away? But this is the truth about us. And we hurt. We get hurt. Everything hurts us. Life hurts us. People hurt us. Places hurt us. And immediately we start building a wall around ourselves. And we try to keep from getting hurt by excluding, excluding, excluding. And it makes us different. And we can't meld ourselves into the society around us. And we are rebels. Not because of choice, but because of the combination of characteristics with which we were born. And we have to learn to live with them in order to live. Well, fortunately for us, when you add alcohol to the combination of characteristics that we have, you have an alcoholic. You have an alcoholic. And fortunately for us, the disease of alcoholism is progressive. And we have to have an answer because we get to the point we can no longer live without it. And maybe we're fortunate enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we see a bunch of drunks that aren't drinking. And we know they're drunks because maybe they look a goody like we do. A couple of headlights here, you know. And they're not drunk. And we feel something in the room, and we hear something that we won't. And we see their eyes, and we see something we'd give our last drop of blood to have. And they tell us, here are the steps we took. Well, now, we didn't come here to find God. I didn't. I didn't even come to get my wife back. She was gone and should be gone. And I wasn't entitled to have her back, and I knew it. I didn't come back to get the love of my kids. I didn't come here to get my job. I came here to find sobriety. And I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth. Just as long as it didn't include alcohol. That's the only thing I hoped for. And you people says, here are the steps we took. We're sober. Try it and see what happens to you. And I did it. And that's all I've done for the last 18 years and 9 months. And I've never had to have a drink since my first meeting. I'm most fortunate in that I've never had a conscious desire for a drink since my first meeting. It's wonderful. Now, what does this all mean? What does this all mean? I'm going to close now with a little parable. A bunch of you have asked me to do it. And this little parable explains me to me, and explains you to me, and it explains us in our relationship to God. It's a fabulous thing. It's something I've known ever since I was born, practically. And it's the story of the prodigal son. This is the only way that the likes of you and me can ever come home. You remember it goes something like this, and I take a few privileges with it, because this is what it means to me. A certain wealthy man, God, had two sons, you and I. And the youngest one of them came to his father and he said, Dad, give me my inheritance. I've got a lot of ideas. I'm going out to California. I'm going to make me a big fortune out there. I've got lots of things to do. The land of opportunity. Give me my inheritance. Now his dad didn't say, wait a minute, son. You got everything you want right here. We're wealthy. Everything that you can think of is right here. Stay home. You're liable to get out there in that far country and get into trouble. away from home, away from your parents. You might get out there and find a blonde with a bottle of muscadoodle and have lots of trouble. No, the father didn't argue with the kid at all. He didn't say a thing. The kid says, give me my inheritance, and he gave it to him. And the kid went away from home. Into a far country. And he wasted his substance on riotous living. Now maybe you didn't do that, but that sounds suspiciously like me. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land. And if anybody should be able to understand the famine, it's us. Again, you come off a drunk, and everybody's hunting for you, and half of them are trying to bank one of your checks with a tennis racket. I don't think they make famines like that no more. There arose a mighty famine in the land, and the kid came to want. So what did he do? Come back home? No. He did just like you did, just like I did. He went to a man in that country. We went to the doctor, the priest, the preacher, the psychiatrist, to Timbuktu. We went every place, just like he did. He went to a man in that country, and the man put him to work. Out of all things that he might have put him to do, he didn't. He put him to tending pigs. Now, this is very significant, because this was a Jew boy telling this story, and the Jews just don't like pigs. They just don't like them. There isn't anything that would be so bad for a Jew to do than to take care of pigs. And so he's telling us that the boy was down. He was down on his luck. We have a word for it in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it a low bottom. And he'd certainly hit it. And while he was in the pig pen tending the pigs, he got hungry. And he fain would eat the husks that the pigs did eat. And the next line is fabulous. And no man gave unto him. He was beyond human help. We have a line for that too. Probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And I think I know that pig pen inside out. I've spent a lot of time in it. And no man gave unto him. And the next line is better than that, because it says the kid came to himself. And I remember that morning in January 1946, when I woke up, and there was no excuse left. There was nothing between me and me. All of them had burned up, and I had to look at me as I was. And the kid came to himself. And he saw himself as he was. And he says, I'm a failure. I've lost the battle of life. I'm a sinner. I'm no good. And while he was taking his inventory in reverse, he remembered that in his father's house was plenty and to spare. But with the self-condemnation of the alcoholic, he says, I can't go back. Say, look, Dad, I'm your boy. Remember me? I've come home. No, he couldn't do it. And I remember when I got to that third step. It was the one thing that threw me. Not because I didn't want to take it. I would have turned my will and my life over to a jackass if I could have gotten rid of me. But I didn't think it was in the cards to believe I could give this mess to anybody, let alone to God. And so it was that the kid says to himself, I can't go back. Ask him to take me back as his son. But he remembered that the servants back there had more than he. And so he made a decision. He was going back and asked the Father to put him on as a hired servant. His decision, I will arise and go to my Father. We got a line like that too. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood. And so the kid started home. And here to me is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here is the thing that just is indescribably wonderful to me. Because the kid starts home and the father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. And the father came to meet me through one of you who had already found your way. And when I was turning to leave the door, he said to me, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. And he says, well, what were you looking for? And I says, well, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety because I thought I was in the wrong place. And man lit up like a Christmas tree. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. Because here was a stranger. A stranger. That was glad I was there. And the father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. And the kid started telling his dad what a bad boy he'd been. And again the father didn't hear him. Never heard him. He never says, yes, I've got the book on you, old boy. You sure are a stinker. I know everything that you've done. I've got it in my book. Now get to grubbing hole and get back here on the back 40. Get working on that persimmon sprouts and the sassafras bushes. And maybe in 25 years, if you do a good job, I'll invite you in for lunch. No. He never heard him. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And he put a ring on his finger, the symbol of eternal life, no beginning and no end. And he called to the servants and he says, kill the fatted calf, let's have a party. The boy was lost. And he's come back home. That God could and would, if sought. It's not normal for us to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. This is not normal. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life with our arms around each other, even as we do today, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal. It is not normal to be away from the Father's house. It is normal to become as little children, totally dependent on this great thing called God. And now everything's good with me. I haven't had a drink. My family was put back together. My health was put back together. My business was put back together. All things are good with me. And yet I'm the most dependent man you'll ever see. I can't run my life. I can't run my business. I can't run my wife. I can't run nothing. And I know it. And so I'm totally dependent on my program, on you, the members of our society, and on my God. But my dependence is not a dependence of fear. It's a dependence of certainty. It's my business to walk in this way. It's my business to practice these principles in all of my affairs one day at a time. It's my business to share me with anybody that wants me in love. And it's his business to take care of me. And he has done an infinitely better job than I. And I think I have at least a faint inkling of what it means, what Carpenter meant when he said, "Fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. But not on my terms, on His. And His terms are too simple for the world. All He asks of me is to act like His kid, to go about my Father's business and inherit sobriety and inherit the kingdom and come back home. God bless you. Thank you."